Let me ask you a question. Have you ever tried to read through the entire Bible? Anybody? Two people. All right. We're going to do a new series about reading through the Bible. No, I'm joking. If you've ever tried, I know you have. I know everyone has tried at some point. If you ever tried to do this, you know it's tough. Because where do you always start? Where do you start? Genesis, right? At the beginning, right? And we all know the famous kind of beginning to the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And it's familiar at first, and it's interesting, and it's kind of fun. And there's some cool stories in Genesis about, you know, sibling rivalry and all kinds of stuff. But then you realize Genesis is really long. Like, it just gets to be pretty long. And so you start skimming and kind of skipping a little bit. But then you get to the next book, Exodus, and it starts off with a bang. It's, you know, about Moses, and we kind of all know a little bit of that story, and God raises up Moses to deliver the people out of Egypt and all that. And that's fun for a little while. But then it gets into there's some strange stories about Moses. And then you get into the second half of Exodus, and it's all these rules. Like, you know the Ten Commandments, but that's like 10 verses. And then it's all these rules and regulations and laws. And then there's all these building codes. It's like verse after verse and chapter after chapter about how to set up and take down a tent in the wilderness and how to build it and construct it and then take it down and what it needs. And it just gets long and tedious, and you're like asking, what's this all about? And so you start skipping and skimming parts of that, and you kind of decide, you know what, I'm sure the next book is going to be awesome. And you come to the next book, and it's called Leviticus, right? And it's going to be awesome. And it is awesome if you think blood and guts and the entrails of sacrificed animals is awesome for chapter after chapter after chapter. And at this point, most of us give up, right? Because it's just so odd. And it's so strange. And it's like, what is this book about? What was this part of the Bible about? It's about this nation of Israel. And yet, they're so ancient, and they're so different, and their worldview and the way they see life and culture is totally, and they have these strange customs, and these strange stories, and these strange laws, and these strange sacrifices. And most of us at that point just kind of just decide, let's just skip the Old Testament. Let's just go to the New Testament, because that's about Jesus, and that's a whole lot easier to read. And yet the problem is, if you don't really understand the nation of Israel and what God is doing with them, which is hard because as you read in the Old Testament, you're going, what is God up to with this ancient people that seems so irrelevant and so not related to my life? I just don't get it. But if we don't understand what God is up to with this nation of Israel, then we're not going to understand the Old Testament. And if we don't understand the Old Testament, that's 3/4 of the Bible, which is kind of an important book for our faith. And so here's what I want to actually do tonight. I have 2 goals. The first goal is to explain to you what God's purposes were with the nation of Israel in the entire Old Testament. So I'm going to do that in just a few minutes. Like, to explain the entire Old Testament and what God was up to with the nation of Israel. But then, if that seems a little overwhelming and daunting and maybe even kind of boring, my second goal is to help you understand, help me understand why that is so important to each of us. Why understanding what God was up to with this nation of Israel thousands of years ago actually has everything to do with your life and my life right now, in our places of work, in our homes, in our families, in our neighborhoods, in every single detail of our lives. Now, we've been reading about this guy named Nehemiah. And the book of Nehemiah is right smack dab in the middle of the Old Testament. But interestingly enough, it's actually the story that Nehemiah tells takes place at the end of the Old Testament. The books aren't always in chronological order. And so the story of Nehemiah actually it's one of the last stories we have before we get to Jesus. So it comes chronologically at the very end of everything that goes on with Israel and the Old Testament. And if you've been here, we've been talking about vision. I mean, that's the name of the series, is vision. And we've been looking at all of these things related to vision through the eyes of Nehemiah and his story. And just to give you a quick, really quick recap, here's Nehemiah's story so far. Nehemiah got a vision, and we'll put this on the screen. He got a vision to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Pretty tangible and specific. Rebuild these walls that are in ruins. These walls around the city that have been in ruins for more than 100 years. And he had to get the king's consent, not the king of Israel, the king of Persia, because there was no Israel anymore. There was just Jerusalem, this little outpost of a city where a few people still lived, a few Israelites, and it was just a city in the Persian Empire. There was no nation anymore. So Nehemiah had to get the permission of the king of Persia, and then he had to travel to Jerusalem, but he had to wait when he got there and let God clarify and confirm this vision. So he walks around, remember the walls at night, to figure out, like, can we really do this? These walls are down. What does it look like to rebuild them? And then he shared the vision with the whole community. He gathered all the people of Jerusalem, which was maybe a few hundred, maybe a few thousand at the most, and then the other people that lived in towns and villages outside of Jerusalem in the province of Judah. And he had to get them committed to rebuilding this wall. And that came with risk, that came with sacrifice, but he cast a vision to them. And then remember when they started rebuilding. Like, they literally started, like, building a wall. And they started getting opposition from all these people. Remember, there's a guy named Sanballat. He lived in Samaria. He was the governor of the province above them. And he was friends with a guy named Tobiah, who was governor of another province. And then there were some Arabs in this other province to the south. And there were people in this other province called Ashdod. So all these other people around Judah that didn't like what they were doing. And so there's all this opposition. And basically, Nehemiah had to rally the troops and say, don't worry, they're not going to harm us. We've got to keep working. We've got to keep building. We're going to have to change our plans. We're not going to be able to build the way we thought we were going to build. But the vision stays the same. And then last week, remember, we saw there wasn't just opposition from the outside. There was opposition from the inside. There started to be division and factions among all the workers and among all the Jews. There were some money problems and some financial problems. And Nehemiah realized, like, the vision's about to die again. And so he had to confront the issues and the problems, and he had to do it with a whole lot of moral authority. And that's where we ended last week. Now, the challenges for Nehemiah didn't stop there. They kept going. Look what else happened. And we're not going to read these verses today, but I want to tell you some of the other things that happened, because all Sanballat and all the other governors didn't stop there. They kept opposing Nehemiah. And here's what happens in chapter 6. We'll put this on the screen as well. In verses 1 through 4, it kind of tells a story. You don't have to turn there. I'm just going to summarize this part. They actually try to harm Nehemiah. They come up with a scheme, and they decide, like, if they can't stop the workers, they'll just take out the leader. And so they try to physically harm Nehemiah. That doesn't work. So then they try to deceive Nehemiah. They come up with this plan to deceive him and take him out that way. That doesn't work. Then they just try to frighten him and discredit him in front of all the people and even intimidate him. And it's like on and on and on it goes. And sometimes visions are like that, right? Sometimes you have a vision for your life, or you feel like there's a goal that you set for something to do, and you start doing it, and it just feels like you hit opposition and barrier and wall at every single step. And for Nehemiah, you got to imagine at this point, he's getting tired. He's getting weary. He's starting to ask questions. God, can we really do? I mean, should we keep going on? Why have you called us to do this? Because it just seems like at every step we're seeing opposition. And yet he keeps moving forward. And the people keep working, and people keep praying. And in fact, all throughout the story, Nehemiah keeps asking God, God, just remember us. He uses that word over and over. Just remember what we're doing. Remember me. Remember all the work that we're giving. Remember our enemies, he actually says a lot of times. Do you see what they're doing? Like, don't overlook that. Remember what they're doing, because they're trying to stop us. But just more than anything, God, remember us. And it's almost like Nehemiah at this point in the story is saying, God, I got to be honest. I don't have much left in the tank. And all I can do is just put one foot in front of another. And all we can do is keep trying to build these walls, but we're kind of at the end. And so we're just trusting you, because we don't know what else to do. We're just going to trust that you want us to keep pursuing this vision, but we're not sure how it's ever going to get accomplished. But God didn't forget. And God remembered what Nehemiah and the people were doing. Because remember, God gave Nehemiah the vision to begin with. God was the one that told him to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the walls. And here's the key. God wasn't just focused on the walls. Nehemiah was focused on rebuilding the walls. But the reason that God gave Nehemiah this vision to go back and rebuild the walls is because God actually had something a lot bigger in mind. God actually was doing something so much bigger and so much broader than Nehemiah even knew, that God wanted to see bigger purposes and a bigger story being written. And that's a reminder to you and to me. When you're getting tired trying to live out a vision in your life, or you've got something you feel like God's called you to do, and you just get to the end and you're just barely hanging on, it's to remember, you know what, God actually may be up to something way bigger than we even know or perceive. That a lot of times it's not just about the specific vision God gives us, but God's got a bigger vision and a bigger agenda and a bigger goal that he's up to in our lives. It's like this. I was thinking about this. You remember when you were in first grade? Who remembers first grade? Come on now. We all do. Remember when you were first learning how to read? And remember your teacher or your parents were teaching you how to identify some symbols on a page. And each symbol corresponded to a sound. And that symbol corresponded, and so you would say that sound, and then you would put these symbols together, and you would put these sounds together, and it would make up a word. And you were first learning how to do that. And then when the teacher called on you to read out loud, to read a sentence in front of the class, it's like you were scared to death and you wanted to get it right. And so it's like you're standing up and you're just focused on saying the sounds of these symbols and saying these words and getting it right. And you don't want to look like a fool, and you just want to make sure you say these sounds right. And that's your agenda. That's your goal. That's all you're focused on. And if you'd asked yourself when you were in first grade, you would have said that's what reading is all about. But then you got to second grade and third grade and fourth grade, and you realized that your teacher and your parents actually had a whole lot bigger goal and agenda in mind. It was something called reading comprehension, because what they wanted you to do is be able to string together the symbols and the sounds to make words, and the words to make sentences, and the sentences to make a story. And when you got into third and fourth grade, you started reading, you realized it opened up your brain and your mind to a whole new wealth of knowledge and information and imagination. But in first grade, all you knew was the goal and the vision is to say these things right and to not look like a fool when your teacher called you in front of the class to read. But the teacher had a bigger agenda, had something bigger going on, wanted to do something so much broader than you ever realized in that moment. And that's the same way with vision. That's what Nehemiah was going on with Nehemiah. Because God said, I want you to rebuild this wall. And so Nehemiah and the people are focused on the wall, and they're mixing mortar, and they're dumping supplies into wheelbarrows, and they're carrying around, and they're laying out plans, and they're measuring things, and they're hanging doors, and they're making sure things are square, and they're putting bricks and stones on top of bricks. And they're focused on the details of this specific vision. And all the while, it's like they're trying to say the sounds, but God is doing something so much bigger and so much broader. And they didn't even realize it. And what it's related to and what God is up to actually has to do with the entire purpose of the nation of Israel in the Old Testament. And so here's what I want to do. I want to take literally just a few minutes and unpack with you what God is up to with the entire nation of Israel. I'm going to summarize it for you. So that way, anytime you're ever reading the Old Testament, you can start to put it in context and figure out what is going on in the bigger picture, in the bigger narrative. So really quickly, here's what's going on in just a few verses. I'm going to read a few verses for you. It starts with a guy named Abraham. Everybody heard of Abraham? He lived in ancient, good job. One person has heard of Abraham. Two people. All right. Three. All right. Anyone else? No. So there's this guy named Abraham. He lives in ancient Mesopotamia. Remember that from like third grade? Mesopotamia and Sumer and all those kind of things. And God speaks to him one day. And he says, I want you to move over to the land of Canaan. And you're going to start a new family there, you and your wife, and you're going to start a new legacy. And this is the promise that God makes to this guy named Abraham. This is what it says in Genesis 12. We'll put all these verses on the screen. You don't have to turn there because we're going to fly through them really quickly. The Lord said to Abram, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. That would be Israel. and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you. And whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. And so right here in this promise to this guy, it's just Abraham and his wife Sarah at this point. They don't worship God. They're not Jewish. There is no Israel. There's nothing. It just starts with these two people. And God says to them, you know what? You're going to have kids, and you're going to have descendants, and it's going to turn into a big family, and it's ultimately going to turn into a huge nation, and I'm going to bless that nation like crazy. But guess what? It's not just for you and your descendants and that nation. I'm doing something even bigger and broader, because through you and through this nation, I want to bless all peoples. And the Hebrew word there can actually be translated all families, all tribes, all clans, all peoples, all nations, all kingdoms on earth will be blessed through you and your descendants. So right here with this guy, God is basically saying, you know what? I'm going to take this nation that comes from your descendants, and I'm going to make them like a light, almost like a lighthouse or a candle that stands in a dark room and shines to all the other nations and all the other people in the world. And somehow they're going to look at you, or they're going to be drawn to you, or you're going to reflect light and me and my glory to them. And I'm going to bring my blessing and reveal myself to all the other people, but I'm going to do it through you, the nation of Israel. And God would do this in so many different ways. He would do it through Israel's laws. Remember all those kind of strange laws that you read in the first few books of the Old Testament? Look at the purpose of these laws. This is Moses talking to the people of Israel right before they're about to enter the promised land in the book of Deuteronomy. Look at what Moses says. See, I have taught you decrees and laws as the Lord my God commanded me, so that you may follow them in the land you are entering to take possession of it. Observe them carefully, for this will show your wisdom and understanding to who? To the nations. To the nations who will hear about all these decrees and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. So Moses is saying, I'm giving you, God is giving us all these laws and we should live by them. Why? Because it's good for us and it's good for our society. But actually, God's got a bigger vision in mind. It's so that all the other nations will look at us and say, wow, look at those amazing laws. Look at that culture. Look at that society. There's something about them and the God that they worship. God would actually do this through battles. You see, back then in that culture, the people believed that when two nations or two societies went to battle and fought against each other, it was like one God against the other God. And whichever nation won, that God was the more powerful God. That's what people believed. And so God was like, you know what? I can work within that. And so he uses the people even in battles that they fight. Remember when the Israelites enter the promised land and they go in and they start winning all these victories against all these other people that are living in the promised land at that time. And one of the people that they come to this town called Jericho. And the first Israelites run into this woman who lives in Jericho. Her name is Rahab. And look at what she says. This is from the book of Joshua. Rahab said to the Israelite spies, I know that the Lord has given you this land and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We've heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted in fear, and everyone's courage failed because of you. For the Lord your God is God in heaven above and on the earth below. So it's like even in battle, God would use that. And when they would be victorious, all the other people would look at them and they would melt in fear. And they say, wow, Yahweh, that God that the Israelites worship, he must be the most all-powerful God. It would even happen with individuals. Remember a guy named Daniel? What's the story we learned about Daniel? Kid, Sunday school, anybody remember? Daniel in the lion's den, right? It was actually in Persia a few generations before Nehemiah. And Daniel was under the Persian king, and the Persian king made this decree. Darius said, you have to bow down and worship me, and you can't worship your own gods. And Daniel said, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to keep worshiping Yahweh. And when he broke the law, they threw him in the lion's den, and God saved him. And then look at what Darius says after this. This is from the book of Daniel. Then King Darius wrote to all the nations and peoples of every language in all the earth, "May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end." So this pagan Persian king who doesn't worship Yahweh sees what God does to this one individual's life, and he says, "Wow, that must be the true God. Everybody, peoples of all nations, and especially of my nation, should worship Daniel's God." Even the Israelites realized this. And so they would pray and they would sing about this idea that God had given them. Look at Psalm 67. They would sing this: "May God be gracious to us and bless us." There's that same word. Remember the promise to Abraham that he would bless the people? "May God be gracious to us and bless us and make his face shine on us." Why? "So that your ways may be known on earth and your salvation among all nations." "May the peoples praise you, God." May all the peoples praise you. You see, they realize God has set them up to be a light. Like a lighthouse, a light to all the nations, to all the peoples in the world. Nobody articulated this better than the prophet Isaiah. You see, the people eventually turned their back on God. They didn't want to be a light anymore. They didn't want that mission. They didn't want that vision. And so God said, "Fine, you're not going to be my light. I'll let the Assyrians and the Babylonians come in and almost wipe you out." And they did that, and they destroyed Israel and Judah and Jerusalem, and they tore down the walls. But God said, "I'm not going to forget about you." And through the prophet Isaiah, even after the people had been sent into exile, here's what God said to the people. This is in Isaiah. He said, "You are my servant, Israel, in whom I will display my splendor. It's too small a thing for you to be my servant to restore the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel I have kept. I will also make you a light for the Gentiles." Gentiles is just a word that means non-Jew. The nations, the peoples, all the people outside of us, that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. In other words, God was saying, "I'm not done with you yet, Israel. I know you turn your back on me, and so I let you reap the consequences of God. But guess what? I love you. You're like my sons and daughters, and so I'm not done with you. And I'll bless you again, and I'll restore you. But guess what? It's not even for you and your sake." I mean, that's part of it, but it's actually for a bigger vision, a bigger goal, a bigger agenda, to reestablish you to be a light to all the nations. See, that's what God, in a nutshell, was up to with the nation of Israel in the entire Old Testament. And that's what makes this story so amazing, because here Nehemiah is at the very end of this period, and the people are drawing up plans, and they're measuring the walls, and they're stacking bricks on bricks, and they're trying to live out this very specific, unique vision that God has given them for their lives in that time. And yet God is actually up to something so much bigger. He's trying to reestablish them to be a light to the nations. And so after all the planning, after all the stacking, after all the working, after all the back-breaking labor, after all the opposition and threats and intimidation, divisions of factions, all the prayers, everything Nehemiah has poured his heart into this vision, look at where it all leads. We're going to read like two verses from the book of Nehemiah tonight. This is where it all leads. Nehemiah tells us in chapter 6, verse 15, "So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. You see, they did it. They finished it. They actually built and completed the wall. And this ragtag bunch of Jews are probably looking around. They hung the last door and they put the last gate in place, and they're looking around going, "I don't know how we did this. We don't know how to build walls. We're not carpenters. We're not stonemasons. I can't believe we actually, but we did it. We accomplished the vision that God gave us. But then look at what Nehemiah says next, and this is crucial. It says next verse, when all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid, and they lost their self-confidence. Stopping there for a second. Literally, the Hebrew reads, all the surrounding nations fell much or fell exceedingly in their own eyes. Remember Sanballat in the north, Tobiah in the northeast, Geshem the Arab, and Ashdod, all these people around them who had like been so opposed to what they were doing, who had been so intimidating, he would call them a bunch of lazy, pathetic Jews. You'll never finish this wall. You're not committed enough. You're not confident enough. You don't know what you're doing. And then they started stationing their armies all around Judah as if they were going to attack them and physically not let them build this wall. Remember, it was like there was just this arrogant attitude that we're in control and we run this part of the Persian Empire. And what you're doing is never going to happen. You'll never finish it. And Nehemiah tells us that when they put the last gate in place and the wall was done, it's almost like Sanballat and all the other people and all the other nations. It's like all that arrogance and all that hubris and all that self-confidence, it just deflated. It's like the wind was just taken right out of their sails. And they became afraid. And they became terrified. And then Nehemiah tells us why. Look at what he says in the next verse. Because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God. So this is huge. God shows up again in such a way that all the other people and all the other nations who were so arrogant, who thought that this ragtag bunch of Jews could never pull this off, could never do it. God shows up in the midst of these people who don't even believe in him. Look at what's been done and look at this vision that's been accomplished and look at these walls that have been completed, and they stand back and they go, how did they do that? And there's almost no way they could have ever. The only way that they could have accomplished what they just accomplished in 52 days, the only way they could have done that is if this Yahweh that they pray to and they worship and they talk about all the time really is real and really did help them do this. And Nehemiah tells us that they became afraid. Why? Because they had heard the old stories about Yahweh. They had heard about the glory days of Israel. They heard about what Yahweh did when the people of Israel were faithful. And so, what God was up to was not just about building walls. It wasn't just providing security for the people who lived in the city of Jerusalem. It was about reestablishing the people of Israel to once again be a light to all the other nations. Now, do you know what I think is really cool about this story? Here's what's cool. There's not a single miracle involved. There's nothing supernatural going on here. I mean, maybe you're here and you're still kind of skeptical about the Bible and all the miracles and all those parts of the Bible. It just, you can't get past those things. What's awesome about this story is there's nothing supernatural or miraculous going on in this story. And for someone, I mean, this is like as normal and as, I mean, they're building a wall, you know? And this is normal and real and ordinary as it gets and mundane. But for someone like me who's been a Christian for a long time, this is challenging. Because I tend to think that the only way that God really reveals himself to people who don't know him or don't believe in him is through really miraculous and supernatural things, right? I mean, I read some of the stories from the Old Testament and I think, God, like, if you could part the sea in front of me, I think people would actually start believing in you. Like, if you could do some of that stuff in my life and right here in Denver right now, I think people would actually believe in you. But what's amazing about this story is it's almost like God shows up in such a way that he just uses the hard work of his people. and the faithfulness of his people as they put one step in front of another, one brick on top of another, and they work hard and they sweat and they toil and they're faithful and they pray and they seek him out. But in the most ordinary of ways, it's like God empowers them and allows them and helps them to build this wall. And then he adds a little bit of his presence and a little bit of his power so that they're able to do it, but almost in an unobservable way, people would stand back and go, I'm still not sure how they did that on their own. Like, there's just something unique about what they just did. There's something different. There's something compelling. There's something unexplainable about what they just accomplished. And it challenges me to consider who it is that they're praying and worshiping to. Now, let me tell you why I think this story and this history and this context is so important for you and for me. Because when Jesus came to be our Savior, when Jesus came to call each one of us to follow him, and he said, follow me, God took the responsibility of being a light to the nations. He took that off of the nation of Israel and he actually gave it to you and to me. Because Jesus showed up, and look at what Jesus said one day. This is from Matthew 5. He said, and he looks at you and he looks at me. He looked at all the people who had just chosen to follow him and he says, you are the light of the world. A town built on a hill can't be hidden. You don't hide a city on a hill. You don't hide a light in the darkness. No, no, no. I want you to let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds or your good works. And then as a result of seeing that, they would glorify your Father in heaven. You see, just like Israel was supposed to be a light to the nations, to all the people, God is now looking at you and me. He's saying, you are a light. You're a light in your workplace. You're a light to your friends. You're a light in your neighborhood. You're a light in your school. You're a light everywhere you go. You are now a light to the world. And I'm going to use you to point people to me. So what is it that God uses? What do people see in us? How does God use each of us to point other people to him? Well, it's not like Israel. He doesn't use our military might. He doesn't use walls and temples. He doesn't use laws anymore. Jesus says he uses our good deeds, our good works. He uses the way we live our lives so that people would look at you and they would look at me and they would say, man, there is something about her. I can't put my finger on it, but there's something about the way she lives. There's something about her outlook, her attitude, her discipline. There's something about him. There's something about what he's doing and how he's living. There's something about that group of people. We went over to dinner at their house the other night, and they invited a bunch of their friends. And the way they interacted with their friends and the way they welcomed us and accepted us and treated us, it's like it was totally different than any other group we've ever had dinner with. There's something about those people that just, we can't explain it, but man, I want that. I want whatever it is that they have. And you see, when we live our lives that way, and when we live out our visions that God has given us that way, whatever specific vision he's given you in your life in this season, when you live it out that way, it's not just for the sake of the vision. Just like Nehemiah wasn't building walls just for the sake of having walls. It's like God is using it in a much bigger and broader way to establish you as a light to all the people around you. God wants to use you, and he wants to use me to get other people's attention onto him. So it begs us to ask one final question tonight. What is it that draws people's attention? I mean, what is it that gets people's attention? Because in Nehemiah's day, it was walls and it was military might and it was all those kind of things. But what is it in our culture? Now, before we put on the screen what I tell you what I think gets people's attention, let me tell you what I think doesn't get people's attention. I don't think putting a fish or a symbol on your car or wearing a t-shirt with a Christian symbol on it, or a wristband with a nice saying on it, or even a tattoo. I don't think branding yourself with something Christian actually gets people's attention. Now, I think it's awesome. I think we should do it. I mean, if it's something that for you is part of your identity and you want to wear that or you know, seal that as part of your identity, that's great. But I don't know that anyone's ever going to come up to you and say, man, I saw that cool like bumper sticker or fish on the back of your car and I want one of those. Like, where can I get one? And tell me, why do you have that? And explain to me what that's all about. Like, that's never going to happen. You know what else doesn't get people's attention? Going to church. That doesn't get people's attention. I'm glad you come to church. I'm glad you're at church tonight. Going to church is a good thing. But I don't know about you, but nobody has ever stopped me on a Sunday when I'm pulling out of my driveway and say, hey, roll your window down for a second. I notice every single Sunday you leave at the same time, or every other Sunday you leave at the same time, and you go to this place, and I'm guessing it's church. And you know what? I have nothing better to do on Sunday. And I've been wondering what that's like. And so can I go with you to church and learn about the things that you do? Like, that is never going to happen, especially not in Denver. That's just never going to happen. That doesn't get people's attention. You know what else doesn't get people's attention? Publicly condemning sins that you don't struggle with. That's not going to get people's attention. Nobody's ever going to come up to you or me and say, you know what? I love the way you're always telling people how wrong they are. I love the way that you are always about what you're against. And it's always the things that you don't struggle with or that you don't like. I love how that always matches up. And so I just want to know, can I be like you in that way? Like, that's never going to happen. Standing up for what we think is wrong and publicly declaring what we think is sin is never going to get, or at least not going to get people's attention in a very good way. Here's what I think does get people's attention. Here's what I think does allow us to be light in our world. Here's just a few suggestions. There's a lot of ways, but here's just a few suggestions. Peace. I think peace gets people's attention. You're going through a difficult time in life. We all go through it, right? We all have those seasons. When you're out of a job for a long time. When there's financial troubles and you go into debt. Where something relationally happens. Somebody breaks up with you. Your family goes bad or something bad just happens. And it's like the hurricane is just swirling around for days and for weeks and for months. And yet at the center of it all, there's still just this unexplainable peace. And you don't have all the answers. And it's not easy. And you don't like it. And you don't want it to be happening. And yet people look at you and it's like, I don't understand how that can be going on in her life. And she can still have a sense of peace. That gets people's attention. You know what else gets people's attention? Is selfless generosity. Selfless generosity. You see, there's a lot of people that are generous. But we don't see a lot of examples of selfless, sacrificial generosity where people are actually giving up their time, their money, their dreams, their agenda, their weekends, their own stuff for the sake of helping and loving and giving to others who don't even deserve it. And when somebody does that, it's like, wow. That doesn't make any sense. And yet there's something so compelling about that. I want that. What is that? You know what else gets people's attention, I think? Long-term relationships. See, we live in a culture that's relationally broken. And I got to be honest, you know, I mean, if I've got a roommate and I don't get along with the roommate, it's easy to just decide I'm going to get a new roommate in a few months. We get jobs where we don't get along with the people in our jobs, and so we quit our job and get another one somewhere else. Marriages, things aren't working out with us and our spouse. It's easy just to get a divorce and go your separate ways. Church. You go to church, you make some friends there. After a few little while, you don't feel like you're getting what you want out of it. You just decide, I'll go to a different church. I'll make some new friends at a different place. That's just the nature of the culture we live in and how most of us are wired and programmed to act. And yet when somebody approaches relationships in a different way and just isn't just out for what I'm going to get out of the relationship, but actually has an attitude that when things get tough and things get hard and things get messy, I'm going to stick in it and I'm going to see if I can make it work for the long run. That gets people's attention. Now, nobody's going to come up to you and say, hey, how do you do that? But I think people will look at you and say, I want to have relationships, friendships, a marriage, a community like that. Last suggestion I would give for what gets people's attention, a relentlessly loving community. A relentlessly loving community. I'm not sure there's any greater witness to God's vision in this world and God's vision for us than when we become a group of His followers who relentlessly love each other. Not because it's easy, not because it's comfortable, not because we love everyone because they're so nice or they're so great or we hit it off with them, and not even a perfect community, but just a community that forgives and is kind and compassionate and just chooses to love each other. Because Jesus said, people will know you're my followers. Why? Because of the way you love each other. Now, all of these things, peace, generosity, long-term relationships, a relentlessly loving community, wouldn't it be great to have all those things in your life? Wouldn't it be great for me to have all those things? Guess what? God wants us to have all those things in our lives, but it's not just for what we get out of them. I mean, sure, it's great if I have peace and I have generosity all in a community like that in my life. I get a lot out of it. I benefit from it. It gives me fulfillment and purpose and meaning. But God actually wants you to have that in your life for a greater purpose, for a greater vision, to be a light to everyone else. And so God says, there's a bigger picture. So even in the mundane, even in the vision, even when you're stacking bricks and building a wall, don't forget that I'm using every part of your life, every vision that I give you, for the sake of something so much bigger than you could ever imagine. Because you're the light to the world. I want to close by reading you a comment that I saw on a blog several months ago. It was there's this blog post. It was by a Christian writer on a controversy that had popped up several months ago about the issue of gay marriage. As you can imagine, this is a controversial topic, and there were a bunch of people that were outspoken and sharing their opinions in all the comments on this blog. And I don't usually read all that stuff, but I just was kind of intrigued by this, and I was skimming through them, and I saw this one comment. And I want to read you what this one person wrote. They wrote this: I'm not a Christian. So reading this and the entire comments section, I remain confused about one issue. What is your evangelical mission? Are you tasked to bring people to Christ or to regurgitate His words to the world? Because many of the commenters appear to believe the latter, which seems both counterintuitive and at odds with the former. Perhaps the most common Christian cliche is the rejoinder to love the sinner but hate the sin, usually spouted by someone who really seems to mean love the sinner but hate the sin loudly, in capital letters. If you really love the sinner and hate the sin, then you would take as your first task, above all else, to just bring sinners to Christ. Let Him convince the sinners to refrain from their sins. Have a little faith in your guy. He was pretty smart. You are unlikely to be more convincing than he is. For people like me who did not grow up in a Christian household or immersed in a Christian community, there is really only one path to conversion: the repeated observation that Christians have something I want but don't have. Happiness, peace, fulfillment. A relentlessly loving family or community. If on the other hand, the only face of Christianity in Christians I see is a parade of self-righteous pricks intent on telling me that the good news is that God has a list of stuff that I'm not allowed to do because, well, he said so, then I don't think you've given God a fair shot to close the deal with me. But at least you can look in the mirror and know that you made God's disapproval very clear. I don't believe what you believe. Nothing you say will convince me that gay people choose to be gay, that being gay is bad, or that engaging in homosexual acts is a sin. You probably can't persuade me that some words are bad, that premarital sex is inadvisable, that people should be required to remain in unhappy marriages, or that human life begins in a real and meaningful way at conception. You have zero chance on your own of convincing me that 2,000 years ago, a man was born of a virgin, and he died on the cross for my sins, and then he came back to life. I'm comfortable with what I already believe. I'm not looking to change any of it. So the onus is on you to find a way to bring me to Christ if you really love me so much. And if I'm you, I look to make my church an irresistibly welcoming place. A beacon, a community that outsiders will be drawn to because of the ridiculously loving people that make it up. Now, I'm not sure that I could have said it any better. To serve as a reminder to you, to me, to us together, that we really are a light to the world. The people really are watching, and that God really was want you and your light to shine before other people so that they would look at us and somehow be drawn to him. Let me pray. Lord God, we want to close tonight by embracing this mission, by embracing this vision, by taking on this responsibility of being a light to the world, by not feeling it a burden, but being excited about it, being passionate about it, being awed by the fact you want to use us, just like you used just a bunch of what other people called lousy Jews to build a wall. And yet you want to use every single one of us, not to build a wall, but to build your kingdom here. And so God, give us an excitement and a joy to enter that vision and to enter that mission with a passion. When we're scared, when we don't know how to do it, give us peace, give us confidence, give us boldness, and help us to just be assured that you are working through us. And you want to do amazing things. And that all we have to do is be faithful and willing to be used of you. And then just stand back and watch you reach others through each of us. We pray this in your name. Amen.